The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. We are your hosts for today. I am Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And we have a very special guest with us today. Special guest, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, yes. My name is Nancy Triano. I'm from Rentokil, North America.
And what do you do?
So I am the Director of Operations Education and Training.
I've always wanted to know why the company is called Rentokil. Are they renting you to kill something?
We get that a lot. Actually, our initial company is in the UK, and that's a term that's very old, and I would say 1920s. I think it was somebody's last name, but they changed some of the letters around. But even at the time, the intention wasn't rent to kill. It was just Rentokil. But it does fit, so how convenient.
I find it quite evocative.
Yes, although I'll say in North America, we really don't, unless we're talking about a national account, we don't really go by the name Rentokil. We have three local names, depending on the region. So either on the east, we're Ehrlich Pest Control, central, we're Presto X, and on the west, we're Western Exterminator. So those are the names you would know us by.
So you guys are the largest?
We are. So globally, we are the largest commercial pest control company in the world. We're in 77 countries. In North America, our size is we're number three.
And then do you train everybody, or you have the, like, you're able to reach all of the employees in that organization?
Yeah, so my charge is North America, and it's the technicians, which we have about 4,500 technicians. They're managers. So across the board, there's a lot of people under my charge. I'm responsible for making sure that they are responsible with pesticide applications, that they know all about bugs, and that they do the right thing. So that's my charge every single day.
How do you feel about us saying, like, you're the private industry version of Jody and I?
I would take that as a compliment, actually.
Okay, cool.
I see a lot of parallels. So I also do a lot of extension, but it's for customers rather than the public.
Did you always want to be an industry professional?
No, actually.
What did you study and where?
So I did the last leg of my academics was at Virginia Tech, and my focus was medical entomology. So I did insect transmitted disease. Primarily, I did mosquitoes and transmission of lacrosse virus, which is the number one cause of pediatric encephalitis in the U.S. And so I always wanted to be a teacher. And so I was an adjunct before I went down and did my PhD, and I wanted to continue on that path. I'm more of the kind of person that likes the community college atmosphere. I love the philosophy of a community college, applied sciences, so taking foundational knowledge and actually giving it to people to apply every day on the job. It was tough to find a job when I graduated, but I went. Somebody had recommended the pest management industry. And so basically, I found that dream teaching job, but I found it in private industry. What I do every day is I take foundational knowledge and I teach people how to apply that into what they do every day on the job. So dream job for me, but not exactly where I thought I would wind up.
Sounds like actually my dream job.
Yeah. I love insects, but they really, if they're not medically significant, they bore me almost. Like, if they can't hurt you, kill you, make you really sick, I'm not that interested. Which is why I was like, went down the whole medical entomology route, and parasitology I love. I actually started at like adjuncting, teaching veterinary parasitology for several years before I even decided to do the medical entomology route.
Yeah. So I think that's really cool. I don't even remember how we met, but I just love you.
No, that's mutual. That's mutual. I always walk away laughing whenever I see you. So no matter what we talk about.
It's usually something gross, though, probably.
That's all part of the fun.
Just like, you know, bugs and education and teaching everyone about all the cool stuff. I think the medical entomology is pretty neat. Your handle's like...
It's BugDoc100. That's my Twitter handle.
You get interviewed a lot for a lot of like popular media. How do people find you? That's usually a question that I have when people find me. because every now and then, I mean, especially working for a university, I'm always like, should I have said that?
Right.
Should I represent well? Am I supposed to talk to someone before I open my mouth and talk to, you know, the media?
And the good news for me is working for a company the size of Rentokil, we actually have a piece of our marketing is dedicated to public relations. So a lot of the media interviews that I do are through our marketing department. So they were in touch with the people that needed to talk to an expert. There's a whole networking thing there that I don't know a lot about, but I get contacted that way. That's the majority. Now, you do have some writers that will just Google different insect subjects and your name pops up. I do get contacted directly, but usually I'll direct them to go through our PR department before they circle back to me to just make sure that everything's on the up and up. So I'm shielded somewhat.
That sounds amazing. Like, I'm super jealous of that process. Yeah, we just get somebody that calls up and is like, I want to talk about, does mint kill mosquitoes? And it's like, okay, like, let's talk about it then.
And I get those questions, but I'm lucky where I get a little bit of a buffer in between. Yeah.
The reason why you're here today is because we're going to talk about bug fake news. And that relates a lot with what we're talking about and accuracy and being interviewed, because a lot of times we're trying to have the truth out, right?
Yes.
I mean, all the time we're supposed to have the truth out, but some of the times we're battling what people are seeing and reading on the internet. So that's misinformation. So the reason that Nancy is here today is because back in October, I saw this amazing talk at Pest World in San Diego, and the title of her talk was Digital Misinformation, How to Sort Through All the Bug Fake News. The unfortunate thing about the situation is that it's a huge meeting, but there are so many different classes you can go to choose from. But I think everybody, all ages and all walks of life, all backgrounds, should listen to a talk like this because it is so relevant today. What can you tell us about your talk? What would you say, like, just a brief overview of what your talk is, and then we'll get into some bug fake news.
Sure. So basically, there's, we're a lot of us are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and often you'll come across posts about insects that are sensationalized or not true. My talk was educating pest management professionals, people in the industry, about the fake news that's out there, and how to stop it, because we all have a responsibility in that space as pest management professionals to stop the proliferation of fake news. So I talked about the complexities around it. And most importantly, I talked about what you can do to stop.
I can't engage in a lot of different aspects of social media because it just infuriates me and I don't want to fight.
Yes.
I mean, I fight for the truth, but I cannot engage with every person on the Nextdoor app, for example, in my neighborhood. Where do you draw the line, and how do we get our messages magnified as much as fake ones?
That's a tough one, Jody. And you're right. You could spend all day debunking myths and all kinds of insect news stories. I think the way I choose it is if somebody, a friend or family, tags me in something and I kind of feel obligated to answer, then I will stop and I'll take the time to read it and I'll say what I think. The one thing that I won't do is just like something or share something out of politeness or because I don't have the time. In that instance, if I just don't want to deal with it, I just don't answer at all, because I think that's a good compromise.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I was wondering if we could maybe set some boundaries about what fake news is. Like, we've heard that term a lot in the last 4 years, right? We're not going to get too political on the show or anything, but it is something that I think is on a lot of people's minds. So when you did your talk, how did you define what fake news is?
So basically, I talked about misinformation. That's something that's untrue. There's misinformation and there's disinformation. When we say misinformation, it's simply something that's not true for whatever reason. There could be a lot of reasons. When we say disinformation, it's also untrue, but usually purposely falsified or coming from a malicious angle. And sometimes things start out as disinformation. Maybe it's a hoax, but then you have somebody with the best of intentions who reads it and doesn't know that it's a hoax. And they share it. And then that disinformation becomes misinformation. So there is an overlap. So, you wind up maybe referring to most things as misinformation.
Okay.
Do we have an example of that?
Well, so when I looked around, there was a big list of things about fake news. It feeds into what Nancy is talking about here about their satire or parody, which then gets misused as like it's the Onion and somebody believes the Onion. So they ate the Onion. I think that's a subreddit that you can get on. There's false connection. So there's when headlines, visuals, and captions don't support what the article is trying to say or what the title might say. There's misleading content. There's false context. So that's when real things are shared with a false framework. So there's something that actually did happen, but it's being misrepresented either in an article or by the person sharing the article. Then there's imposter content, which you may deal with a little bit at Rentakill, I would guess, where they might take something you've produced off of your website and they present it on Facebook or on Twitter. They have their blaring headline above it, but it's not what you actually wrote or produced. So they're using it in being an imposter with an actual source. There's manipulated content where genuine info is manipulated to deceive, and fabricated content, which is my favorite, where it's 100% fake and false and somebody just made it for the lulz and they're a troll and they wanted to watch people spread it around the internet. That's the one I think I can think of the most examples for. How about you two?
I don't know. They all kind of blend together for me.
Yeah.
Like when you were like talking about each one, I was like, ooh, maybe that would be, you know, the Bella Stamatid. Now and then I was like, ooh, maybe that was like Jim Kalish's Woodlouse Hunter. They all blend together as just being wrong.
Yeah. And insects are to complicate that, insects are often the subject of sensational news because people are fascinated by them, but they're horrified by them at the same time. And so something that evokes such emotion in people is likely to be perpetuated and shared. And what could start out as a hoax to invoke such emotion, somebody's going to take it and just being a good Samaritan, unknowingly, they're going to share it and it's going to keep getting shared.
Right, because they want to protect you from this new killer insect that's taking over the United States and will kill your whole family.
Exactly.
And also, I think that complicates it is that insects are so cool. There are some really cool, outrageous, amazing, wow, I can't believe that things about insects. So, you know, some things are actually partially true, but then perpetuated to a level of fear that makes so much hate. You know, bot flies, we think are cool as entomologists, but everyone's going to fear that. All the sweat bees in the eyes this year.
The insects in the ears.
So I don't know, what kind of fake news is that?
Oh, gosh.
Like, it's real. It can happen.
Right.
And I think that's why it's difficult when there is something that's completely false to try to work so hard to get out what's accurate.
Right.
I know you came up with a lot of good ones during your talk. You want to say some examples?
There's no shortage. You know, when I was coming up with this talk and all of the complexities around it and all of the examples that Jonathan was saying, I paired each with an example of that. There was no shortage on the internet. So some things that get shared, do-it-yourself insect remedies and pest control remedies. And some of these things at the end of the day, by the way, are dangerous. They could be dangerous. You're doing people a disservice by sharing them. But there were funny ones too. So there's one post going around and it's a big Ziploc bag full of water with a penny in it. And it's supposed to repel flies. The reflection of it repels flies, quote unquote. There's also a lot of things circulating about how to make your own insect repellents. You know, going to a Whole Foods type store and getting natural oils or essential oils and diluting that in water and spraying that on your skin rather than DEET. You know, at the end of the day, I want to be protected. And I'd rather use the EPA regulated insect repellent on my kids and myself and whatever veterinary products there are on my pets rather than these DIY things that are floating around on the internet. At the end of the day, you could wind up harming yourself.
I think that one in particular has so many layers, right? Like they're preying on people's fears of disease. They're preying on the annoyance of mosquitoes, but they're also preying on this modern essential oil phenomenon and people's distrust of chemicals, quote unquote chemicals, and chemical companies and the government. I just think that when we start talking about this stuff, it gets so multifaceted so quickly and it's hard.
It's so complex.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's a whole psychology around, you know, our tendency to believe these things and why we share them. I mean, we tend to believe in articles that align with our own beliefs. So if I'm mistrustful of insect repellents and DEET, I'm going to start, you know, I'm really going to trust articles that are more DIY and why they're good for me. And the more people who share them, the more popular they're going to become. And there's also studies that say that the popularity indicators, like the likes, the shares, the more likes and shares something has, it changes our perception of the article. And we tend to believe that it's true, when in fact, there's no link between accuracy and popularity. It's our perception. And so it's so complicated, but we tend to share things. And then you've got other factors like algorithmic filtering on social media. So if I share something about DIY home remedies, well, the algorithmic filter, social media is programmed to show me things that it thinks that I want to see. So it's going to show me 6 more articles like it. And that's going to perpetuate the spread of additional misinformation. So it's very complex, actually.
It's so bizarre. Like, the part about the algorithmic filter, it frightens me so much to hear that, because I know that's what happens to a lot of people that end up speaking to Jody and I, is like, they've just read so many things because it's just getting shoved in their face. It's this hopper of information every day that they can just log into and see things that agree with them.
Well, and that our phone is listening to us. Right. So like, we start talking about insect repellent, I'm sure I'll get all these different things about insect repellent. You know, when it comes to that something is biting them, why do you think that's a bug? And it turns out to be, well, what else could it be?
Yep.
Well, a lot of things.
Yep.
But, you know.
Yep. And here's the thing, Jody, what's so important about us is that we're a trusted source, and people are social learners, and they believe things that their trusted sources say. So you're a trusted source if you say something about bugs, or you comment under an article that has anything to do with bugs on social media. Where my big crusade on this started was when I realized, I know I'm a trusted source. Okay, I'm an entomologist. I have a lot of training on this. But when I look at the technicians in my company who are really good at killing bugs, they're not necessarily entomologists. I'm friends with some technicians from my company, and one of them last year shared an article on brown recluse spiders. This article was just full of misinformation, and he shared this article with the best of intentions. He's not an entomologist, but you know what? He's a bug man, and his friends know him as the bug man. And, you know, as far as they're concerned, if he's going to share an article like this, it must be true. You know, I looked at his friends list, and he had over 200 friends on Facebook alone. And then I took a step back and I thought, this is one technician. In my company alone, there's 4,500 technicians. That's 4,500 trusted sources. And if I took a bigger step back, there's tens of thousands of technicians in the pest management industry in America alone. And these are tens of thousands of trusted sources. And so as an industry, we have to up our game. And there's a call to action to become media literate now, because there's just so much misinformation spreading. So we have a responsibility as anybody in the pest management industry to learn more about this and to stop it, which I know we're going to talk about.
Can you tell us more about the recluse article that was shared?
There was a story about somebody being bitten by a brown recluse spider, and then, you know, his skin sloughed off. But by the way, it wasn't in a geography where brown recluse spiders are known to reside. And nobody actually saw the brown recluse spider. That's what the doctors think it was. And we know in general that brown recluse spiders are often maligned, and they're often pointed to by healthcare professionals as the culprit to all of these skin wounds and lesions. And we also know that the reality is that most of the time you weren't bitten by a brown recluse spider. There was another cause for your sloughing skin or your gaping wound. And this was just one of those typical articles. And I read it, and I was, you know, that's when I really thought about it. And I thought, this guy is, you know, he's got really good intentions, but he's the bug man, and he's a trusted source, and he wouldn't have known otherwise. I mean, he's not an entomologist. I don't expect him to know everything about brown recluse spiders. And so that's when I really started thinking, hey, we've got a call to action here.
If the brown recluse is not in that area, then we need to talk about geographical distribution and trying to communicate with clients and homeowners and the people they deal with on the communication aspect of it, because I think it's really hard. I was a technician for a couple of years, and I think the hardest thing is if you are into service, doing the action, but the communication bit gets very difficult if you're not a people person. I mean, the customer service is so much a part of what you need to know and to perform your job and to create that value of having a professional come and service at home. When you're talking about us being trusted sources, I think this is one of the problems that the woodlouse hunter spider got such negative feedback for UNL, because they were Jim Kalish's pictures, and he was at the UNL entomology lab for many, many years. He takes a lot of pictures that we use in the industry and through a lot of our professional presentations. But someone posted about this new deadly spider spreads across the USA, and it was his picture that has the watermark that says, you know, University of Nebraska. So I don't know where that fits into that category, but that's a trusted source. Like, people
that was what people used to validate it.
People thought, like, Jody Green is sending this to me. She is from UNL. Like, Jonathan, what are you doing? What's happening? You're trying to warn us. And that just spread everywhere.
Yep.
Right. And
I would say that's imposter content. Like, they took a genuine piece of information that, that Jim had made. He had made a great photograph of this spider, and somebody was like, I think this is going to be really funny to trick all these people on the internet. I'm going to make all these grandmas share it on Facebook and get them all riled up, right? Like, I think that's just a subset of humanity that's what they like. They like stirring the pot.
Like, all caps, the spider from hell. Five people have died this week due to the bite of this deadly spider. And in reality, this spider is so cool. It's got crazy jaws, but it feeds on, like, pill bugs and sow bugs under rocks. Like, they're so neat. They're not deadly. I mean, sure, if you roll on it on the ground, maybe you'll get a poke. Maybe it'll hurt because of those jaws. But they are not killing people.
No.
Spiders that we have here are not out to kill us or bite us. That's mostly defense, right? I mean, there's so many negative things about spiders.
Poor spiders.
Poor spiders.
Poor spiders. But think about the emotions that seeing that picture and all those caps evoked in people that don't have that background. Studies show that we're 70% more likely to share fake news than we are true news. And there was actually a study that looked at your emotions before you hit the share button. And so emotions associated with true news are, could be joyfulness or unhappiness. But emotions associated with fake news are shock and amazement. And so you're much more likely to hit that share button. So probably, Jody, with the woodlouse spider, you know, people were just that much more too inclined to share it because it evoked such emotion.
Like, it brought everybody, it brought so many different states in, and it, like, brought your family and friends in, the government. It had everything to just blow up and get to be what it was.
Right? I'm really excited by what Nancy said, because I think that's important for a lot of scientists to hear, because when we write about things in the scientific community, would you agree, it's often very antiseptic, it's very dry, it's not engaging with people in an emotional way. It is something that is probably factually accurate, and it's something that's probably interesting, but when we describe it, or when we generate our little publications that even we put on Facebook and things, it's often not written in a way to connect on that emotional spectrum. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. I mean, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but admittedly, not everybody wants to read a dry science article. Most people aren't going to get excited about it.
Yeah, and then is it, like, ethical to have a clickbaity title and then just be like, nah, we're just going to tell you the truth, right?
Oh, and Jody, that's something we didn't even talk about yet, and Jonathan, about clickbait, and that's another huge complicating factor here.
So what is clickbait?
So fake news is a highly profitable business. Clickbait is, you know, the definition of clickbait is just that you're baiting somebody to click on your post. And it all has to do with digital advertising. So there's a lot of money to be made in digital advertising. So getting you to click on an article, so all of these digital ads pop up. There are companies out there that create fake news for clickbait just so you will click on and see all of the digital ads. And this is lucrative. They report making anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 a month to create fake news articles or clickbait headlines so you can click on and see all the digital ads pop up. And so you might not even know that you're duped some of the time. A lot of these fake news articles have the look and feel of real news. I had a professional person, a doctor, send me an article about meadow restoration and how all of this wildlife was coming back. And when I clicked on it, all of these digital ads popped up, and it was maybe two paragraphs of nonsense. And I know we'll talk in a little while about how to really sort through. But even this professional person who sent me this article didn't know that that was clickbait. And so you have yet another complicating factor. But here's the thing, since it's such a highly profitable business, there's not going to be any shortage of fake insect news anytime soon. So I think you also have that.
So how can we tell if something is fake news? What can we do to navigate through it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that's just so important for all of us to become media literate. The first thing that I do when I click on an article is look at the source. You look at the author, you look at where it's coming from. So any extension with a .co is a red flag. So usatoday.com, good. usatoday.com.co, bad. And so a lot of these fake news articles will add an extra extension on. So they'll take what we know of to be a valid news source. But then if it's .co afterwards, you know that it's not the real deal. The first thing I would say is always, always look at the author. There should be, if it's valid content, there should be an About Us section. You want to look at dates. We have the tendency to share things without looking about when it occurred. And I've had people share news with me that is something that happened 2 years ago. Those are some good immediate first steps. I actually have a list of things, but I'll come up for air if we want to break this down.
I like the checking the date one just because it reminds me of last year when the polar vortex came through. Everybody started talking about all the brown marmorated stink bugs are dead, right? 95% of them. And they were sharing this article. And it was going around really hot and heavy there for a couple of days. And it turned out it was from 2014. And it was kind of a manipulated data set anyway that was misquoted. And poor Thomas Kuhar at Virginia Tech had kind of gotten put through the ringer just because his data had been misused. And then he had to deal with it all over again 5 years later with another polar vortex. Yeah. So they were saying it was going to kill 95% of the stink bugs. Of course, everybody wants that because they hate the stink bugs. But it's not even what he said. It's just blown out of proportion. And then people just read the headline and they're like, oh, I want to tell all my neighbors about this. And they don't even check to see that it was from 5 years before they were clicking share.
Yeah. And then nowadays, with how far they've been distributed and how bad they are in some places, it's different. Can you tell if something's been Photoshopped?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the best thing I can say is if you are suspicious of a picture, right click on it and do a reversed Google image search. Right click on it and it will pop up to do a Google search on it. For the example of that woodlouse picture. So, you know, if you see a picture and you're suspicious of the article, do a reverse image search, because if that picture was used in other contexts, in other articles, it will pop up under Google. So that's a good first step. So do that. Also, if you see a headline and it's just really something that you're suspicious of, maybe it's a little bit on the wild side. If it really happened, if it's really news, other media outlets will have picked it up. So Google it. And while on the subject of Google, Google it. Google that news event. If there was a plane crash somewhere, or I mean, I know we're not really talking about things other than insects. So let's bring it back to insects. So if there's an outbreak somewhere or a new insect, this deadly spider, Google it and see if there are other media outlets that have picked that up, because that's another indicator.
Yeah, you're actually talking about a lot of things I do, but I don't do it even consciously anymore. Like, yeah, I look at the dates. Yeah, I always do look About Us. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that person, you know, I know that person.
And that's good. Then you naturally have started to do that. That's a good foundation for being media literate, which is good. We just need so much more of it. But then validating your sources too, it's important to go to places that are trusted. And I would always tell people, go to government websites. So CDC, state government website. So it will have a .gov extension, or go to a university website. It will have a .edu extension. Those are the two main places you want to go to validate insect science news.
The about us, or I see who's been quoted, then I usually Google that person, see who they're affiliated with, yes, what their institute is, yeah, where they studied, like, are they entomologists, things like that too. I get a lot of people in the community to say, well, I read this on the internet, I saw this on the internet. And I'm like, you know, anybody can put anything on the internet.
It's not good enough.
You know, it's not good enough. I put stuff on the internet. Did you read my stuff? This is what I would say, you know. I also go to a place called Snopes.
Yes.
Right? Is that a good place to go?
Snopes is a great, it's a great place to go. Snopes will actually rate the articles, and they have a bunch of different ratings from being completely false to partially false to true, partially true. And they have explanations, but they will give you what the facts, the sources, what they have found. So Snopes is another good, depending on what we're looking up, I would say go to Snopes, definitely.
So if you feel like something may not be true and you look it up, you can go to, is it Snopes.com?
Snopes.com, yes.
And then they will either
They will give you as much background, the origin of, you know, where the piece of news started from. And they have a whole rating system. I believe it's like 12 different ratings, and you can read what each means. But then you take that for what it's worth. You look at how they've rated it. Is it partially true, totally true, or the opposite? Yeah. So it's a pretty good unbiased way to look at something.
Well, that's good.
It's a great source.
Yeah. It's like myth busting, right?
Myth busting. Yes. Yes.
I love on Snopes when they go through the origins of it, because I like that kind of archaeology on our culture to find out where these sorts of things started popping up. My favorite example is, so before Facebook and everything, I remember getting email forwards from family members about Arachneus gluteus. Did you ever get this one in the past?
The blush spider, the South American blush spider.
Exactly. The spider that was hiding under toilet seats, and its scientific name means butt spider, and it's called the blush spider, and it was biting people's rear ends and killing them. I remember getting that forwarded to me from a great uncle, and he was like, is this true? And I, you know, that was when it starts. Like, it starts very young with entomologists, where you have to start debunking these things.
Yes.
Because that was 2004, I want to say, that I remember that.
Yep.
Yeah.
There are different iterations of that South American blush spider story that have circulated. Actually, when I was doing my research for the fake bug news talk, that was one of the stories that there was actually a lot of history on the different. And I think it was Snopes that I found that wrote the origins of the different rumors for that.
Yeah, I think it's like a Hall of Fame member of this fake news kind of stuff. What are some other favorite ones that you've encountered over the last few years? I mean, I think we can all list probably a dozen, but do you have one that really sticks out in your head that either you were tagged in and people were asking you about, or you just stumbled across it and you were like, holy cow, this is evil and wrong?
I think besides the ones we have already discussed, one that rears its head every few years seems to be the triatomin bugs, the kissing bugs. And even though they exist here in 28 states, they're suddenly here spreading Chagas disease and biting people who are sleeping. And there's just a bunch of different stories circulating about kissing bugs. And you'll see that rear its head, you know, every couple of years, it seems like get on them.
Tapping into some fear there.
Yes.
What is the truth about kissing bugs?
So the truth about kissing bugs, we do have kissing bug species here already. They're not new to the United States. They're actually in 28 states, and there's different types of kissing bugs. So you've got ones that are domestic, ones that are sort of peri-domestic, and then you've got wild or sylvatic types. And we really have the wild types in the U.S. The ones that are known for spreading Chagas disease are the domestic species of kissing bugs. And we do not have the domestic kissing bug species here in the United States. But people don't know kissing bugs to that level of detail. And we do have kissing bugs here that you could legitimately photograph and say, oh my gosh, I heard these things spread Chagas disease. So of course you've got a lot of misinformation.
Yeah, I've had people in Nebraska call me and tell me they've just been tested for Chagas disease. And I'm like, why did you do that? And then they'll send me a picture. And I'm like, no, that's like a Western conifer seed bug. Like, send that to me before you get tested. And sometimes I think if we had a, I don't know if it's a communication or relationship or what with sometimes the medical profession, that we could give them that information, because then they would say, no, you don't have to be tested for Chagas because we don't have, you know.
Right. You actually bring up a really good point, Jody, about working in collaboration or using our powers to work in collaboration with medical professionals. I actually say too, if you're from a larger pest control company or you have some kind of media outlet, use your powers for good there too, and try to put out articles that debunk those things. So the last time the kissing bug reared their ugly heads in the news, they're not ugly to me, but the articles were ugly. We went to work in our marketing department in Rentokil and put out an article all around the facts about kissing bugs. So that was really what we did to try to stop some of the, you know, the fake stuff from spreading around. So if you have the means to do that, do it.
We just started doing that after the Asian giant hornet discovery in Washington, because we've already had multiple people in Kentucky before this fine start talking about that it lived here. They catch European hornets or cicada killers. And so there's already some veins of misinformation on the internet about it in Kentucky. And then it's discovered in America. So now it's everywhere. And so we already are trying to put out those fires.
So what is the truth?
Well, the truth is that we only found one or two, and I think it was up in Washington State.
Correct.
The other truth is that honeybees can unleash some defenses, natural defenses against these. So nothing is, we don't have evidence of establishment yet or spread within the U.S. We did find a few up in Washington State. That's all we know right now.
And in Vancouver. Okay.
In Vancouver, yes.
But that's just Canada. One of my favorite ones that I remember reading, I think I shared it with Jody when I first discovered it a couple years ago, is, do you know what trypophobia is?
No, do tell.
Okay, trypophobia is the fear of holes in things. And usually it's preyed upon by these Photoshopped images where they take pictures of flowers, like seed pods that have lots of holes and the seeds are hidden inside.
Right.
And they Photoshop that on people's palms or on their cheeks. And you can get makeup at the Halloween store that does it. And there was this thing that got shared on my Facebook feed. I saw it, that there's a new bug that was found in India that's spreading a virus that causes your skin to do this. And they had all these Photoshopped images where people's palms were full of holes and their fingers were disintegrating, like the Avengers in Endgame. And it just looked really gnarly. And it was a real bug. It was a real thing. And it has all of its eggs on its back. That's why it looks weird. But it was this thing.
Oh, it was like the water bug.
Yeah, it was
I actually had that example in my talk, but I didn't know the term trypophobia.
I think I'm saying that right. Yeah.
Yes. That was actually the example that I used when I was talking about the powerful emotions that some fake news can evoke in you, and your tendency to want to share as a result.
Yeah.
So yes.
Some of my friends were sharing that a couple years ago, and I have to imagine it's because it looks disgusting. It's a horrifying picture of your finger disintegrating, and it's a gross bug. So yeah, we talk about this as bad, right? We talk about tapping into those emotions as manipulative, but do you think we should do it more as scientists? Like, is there a way to harness this power for good?
I think if you're excited about something, you know, break out your thesaurus, then maybe you can describe it creatively or capture it. Maybe we need a lesson in creative writing as scientists to try to evoke those emotions and some of the things that we do that are the truth. That's a really good perspective, Jonathan. I hadn't thought of it that way.
It seems like it could be like the Force. You can use it for good or for evil.
I love it.
Yeah, I think it is something that we could use as a tool if we're willing to. And it is probably like fire. We could probably burn ourselves. But if we have to combat these people, I wonder if it wouldn't be helpful to adopt some of their methods in some cases. Jody, do you have a favorite fake news story?
No.
You just have too much to choose from.
I do. I even went back into like my Facebook messages, because usually that's where I get like the shares. Like, I don't even know if they even say a word, like true question mark or just a question mark.
Just
like,
30 question
people
marks.
People have not really fully communicated with me in a long time. It used to be, what is this? And now it's just a question mark.
We're getting lazier and lazier.
Yeah, like, I don't know if it's possum eating spiders or this eating that, or, you know, like, how things are, like, how the image is taken, how it looks bigger than it is, or I don't know. I don't have a favorite because there are just so many, and I don't know if it's actually the favorite because it's super weird, or if it's just the reaction of people and how they tag me and drag me into it. My social media, like, on Facebook is pretty bad because I cannot handle when people are like, you need to burn it with fire. That is ugly, blah, blah, blah. Like, because I have tarantulas and, you know, scorpions and spiders around me that I care about. And it offends me when someone calls it ugly. I don't do that to their kid pictures or their puppy pictures. That would be rude. But it doesn't seem rude to them when they say things about, like, my profession or my bugs or some of the pictures I take. You know, they'll say, oh, that's ugly and I would hate it and I could never do what you do.
Yes. Yeah, we have to get a thick skin, or a cuticle, if you will. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
that's why you have to surround yourself with other weirdos.
Right. And then, but then you only share your bug stuff with people who like it, and then you're not being like inclusive. So there's just so many issues with educating, because you want people to know the information, and they take what they can from it, but they always seem to spread the negative or spread the more sensational. I don't know. I try to balance it out. But I think that what your lessons and your presentation had to say was good for everybody, because even if it's not about bugs, there are a lot of things that are not accurate out there. So like for young people, especially for old people, you know, for people that can get taken advantage of and go down a path that is really, you know, will either cost them money, will trick them into something. Youth can get into so much danger believing things that aren't true, following things online. So
yeah. And if you think about today's world, we have some quick statistics, but 7 hours of YouTube video is uploaded every single minute, and 95 million photos and videos are shared every single day. So you think about the potential that social media brings with it to share and spread fake news, Jody. It's incredible. It's scary.
It is terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when we have kids, see things on the internet. And now my daughter texted me the other day and she was just like, do you think the dog is going crazy and pacing around because she can predict the storm? And I said, I don't know. She's like, well, I just Googled it and she is predicting a storm. I was like, okay.
It's a whole new set of challenges with this generation, isn't it? It's so different. That's why Right along with teaching our kids how to use the internet, we have to pair that right up with how to be media literate and how to use it responsibly. It's time for everybody to be brought up to the same level of media literacy. And we can't assume that just because you're a professional that you know how to look at an article and determine if it's real or not.
I'm fascinated by the role of like digital native generations in that, because it does seem like for some people in certain age groups, they're teaching that lesson in both directions, right? We have to teach our parents and our children about some of this, because I don't know about you two, but I think I've spent more time talking to people who are 55 and over about, oh, I saw this on the internet, and they share it with me, or they bring it up in conversation or phone call me about it. And I have to be like, well, that's fake. Like, that's not real. And you could have done this amount of research, like 2 seconds worth of research to figure it out. But it just seems like it's the role of this one sect of society to teach both directions. They have to teach parents and kids about it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We've got a lot of work to do.
And then maybe it'll all catch, like, it's a lot of initial investment, but it'll all catch up in the end.
I try to teach, you hear something or you may feel something and ask yourself, is that true? If someone said something about you, is that true? What did they see? What's their truth? Like, what did they see that makes them perceive that? And how do you feel? And if you read something, is that true? Before you share it, before you let it really get to you, find out if it is a true thing
Yeah, that's a great point. Ask questions. Question everything. It, go with your gut instincts. Question everything. And when in doubt, don't hit the share button. Even if you want to, say, hey, let's put this on pause. I'm really busy and let me look at it later. That's the best thing you can do. Mm-hmm. Don't share it.
Can I ask you some fun questions?
Yes.
So if you were not an entomologist doing what you do, what would you be doing?
Okay, so secret shame time. I have to admit, I'm going to tell you, a marine biologist, but here's why. Because my secret shame is that my favorite arthropod is a crab. Not insects, but crabs. Those are crustaceans. Crabs are my very favorite critters in the whole world.
I'm glad you specified crustaceans in that crabs, not insect crabs.
Not Theris pubis. I enjoy the crab louse for other reasons. I like parasites, but no, I'm talking about crabs as in the crustaceans.
Any crabs or like fiddler crab, coconut crab?
I could say so many good things about so many different crabs. I love fiddler crabs, especially. I love that one claw is bigger than the other. I love how they shake it at you.
Yeah.
You know, they're like an angry little old man. If you get too close, they go and they shake their claw at you, and then they disappear into their little hole. I mean, it's adorable. They got those eye stalks on the top of their head and they're looking in different directions. How do you not look at that and just become absolutely delighted by nature? I'm in love with crabs. So that's like my secret shame, is that insects are not my favorite arthropod.
That's awesome. Now I know what to get you for Christmas, or as a thank you gift for being on the show.
Do you have any pet crabs?
I don't. In fact, crabs are really tough. You really can't breed them. And so if I were to get pet crabs, they would have to be wild caught. And so one, I'm not such a huge fan of that. Two, I'm too busy to take care of. I would want to make sure that I would be devastated if anything ever happened to it. So I don't have the kind of time to devote in keeping crabs. So I don't.
Do you eat crab?
I don't. I find crabs too adorable to eat. What I do have are field guides, and actually I have a 2020 bucket list. I asked for Christmas. I asked for a few different East Coast field guides for oceans and wildlife. And so I've got all of these different crabs marked down that I plan on finding this year.
That is awesome.
So, yes. And what are you going to do when you find them? Take a picture, hug it?
All of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. Maybe video clips in there too.
If someone calls you crabby, do you think it's like the best compliment in the world?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure. No, I'm going to say no on that. If somebody were to say I was cute as a crab, that would be a compliment.
So if you had an arthropod superpower, would it have something to do with crabs?
Ironically, no. I'd have to go back to insects on that. My arthropod superpower, if I could have one, it would be to fly like mosquitoes, undetected, light, sneak in, land, do what I have to do, and then get out of there without having to talk to anybody. Although I'm incredibly, incredibly social, I just love the idea of being able to come and go undetected.
Ninja Nancy.
To fly. Yes.
I know. It always seems like they know when you're watching. Like if you were not doing anything but watching, they just do that biting thing behind your back.
Yeah. Right? Right. I guess I hope that doesn't say anything about me. I'm not malicious or antisocial, nor do I prefer to drink blood. But
takeaways from the show: fake news is bad. Nancy's a vampire and she likes crabs. We really want to say thank you for being on the show. It's really awesome to get to talk to cool experts out there who are looking at really interesting avenues of entomology. And so I really enjoyed this topic. I was really happy when Jody brought it up. And I hope our listeners also enjoyed hearing about it. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
And we hope that you all enjoyed it. If you want to catch any of us on social media, you can find the show at @Arthro_Pod Show on Twitter. Jody is?
At Jody Bugs Me, UNL.
I'm at Bugman John. And Nancy is?
At BugDoc100.
That's a really good Twitter handle. I like that one. You can find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, podcatchers of all different shapes and sizes. And if you do find us on those different streaming services, it would be really nice if you could leave us a rating, maybe leave us some stars. That helps get the word out about the show. And we would greatly appreciate that. We hope you'll tune in here in another couple of weeks when we have another great entomological, educational, entertaining show for you. So catch you then and there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
You have to be careful what you say. Every now and then I'll hear something that I said that I didn't know I said on record.
I appreciate you pointing that out, Jody. Unbelievable, Jonathan.
I've never blackmailed anybody.
True. Yet.